Good morning. It's the Olympics. It's Paris. Any excuse to break out du fromage.
Bonjour, Kate.
Bonne chance et merci beaucoup.
Well, merci à vous and bonne chance back in Paris.
Mamouzen, our bouche people, hair toss. We'll be expecting more of that. And if you were looking at last night's opening ceremony, that flotilla down the Seine, it was formidable. Despite yesterday's arson attacks on the rail system. And for the next few weeks, it will be all about the athletes, their training, their sacrifice, the dedication. But for now, let's take a moment for the frocks, the rig out, the threads, the ooh-la-la. It is Paris, after all. And our Irish athletes were wearing Laura Webber.
Wearing a white suit, but a much more relaxed fabric, not a traditional suit fabric.
Yeah.
Knit shirts and custom shoes.
And I believe Sonia O'Sullivan's outfit that she wore in the 2000 Olympics in Sydney, that's an inspiration. Is it for the closing ceremony jacket?
Yes. She actually came to my school when I was a young kid and she ran through our playground and high-fived all the kids and we never wanted to wash our hands again. She inspired the closing ceremony jacket. A much more relaxed bomber, kind of 90s style vintage jacket that they can be a little bit more playful in. The games are over. It's time to enjoy and celebrate.
So it's a really retro cool, isn't it?
Yes, it went down like a house on fire.
No, you've done a really clever thing. The strapping that you've put around this green jacket, which is the kind of baggy style 80s, 90s tracksuit from the kind of warm down outfit that we would have seen Sonia on the podium with. Tell us about what happens if they win a medal. It's incorporated,
so,
isn't it?
The strapping frames their heads. So there's 2 points on the front of the jacket and 2 points on the back of the jacket. And when they wear a medal down the center of the jacket, it creates a fifth point forming a star. And from bird's eye view, it's a star around their heads.
And you also might have spotted embroidered tweed county patches, all to pay tribute to their communities. But only 31 counties.
What happened?
You know what? Next LA Games, there'll be 32. It's definitely...
Leitrim was left out. Is it Leitrim that's missing?
Leitrim is missing.
There was no athlete picking Leitrim.
Oh, poor Leitrim. And for the sum 10,500 athletes in the Olympic Village, this is the culmination of all of their dreams. With one small snag.
You remember the last Olympics, they had the cardboard beds as part of the sustainability and all that because they want to be throwing out beds after being used by the athletes for hygiene purposes. So they're made out of cardboard and a lot of the athletes were joking that they were anti-sex beds. So Rhys McLenachan, who's our great hope in the pommel horse for a gold medal, he's 25 years of age. He has been trying out the beds and he's basically saying, well, are they sturdy enough to do whatever you want to be doing on them? Here's the message from Rhys himself.
I'm at the Paris Olympic Games and I once again have these cardboard anti-sex beds. When I tested them last time, they withstood my testing. Maybe I wasn't rigorous enough though.
Wow.
Nope, they passed the test. It's fake. Fake news.
Fake news.
So the beds, check. Tested, fit for purpose. And you might need some slow-release energy foods. Here's nutritionist with Team Ireland, Sharon Madigan. And a Ray, who's in his happy place.
Porridge. But the Parisians, they wouldn't be so fond of the porridge.
No, and it's really funny because many years ago, not the last World Cup, but the one before it in rugby, they didn't know how to make porridge. And one of my colleagues who was working in the IRFU, Ruth Wood Martin, actually had to do a video to show them how to make porridge. But certainly there is porridge available. And actually, it's one of the first messages that you get that the porridge is gone.
But enough frippery, this is a serious business because today alone, a lot of sport. With Philip from Paris, Damien O'Mara.
Rowing, swimming, I'm going to forget the sports now at the top of my head.
Boxing.
We've got show jumping, equestrian sports. they're outside the window doing charades at me to try and remind me of some of the sports that are involved, which is the highlight of my Olympics so far. But yeah, I think we counted in excess of 30 Irish athletes could be in action across the day. And listen, like I've used the same cliche time and time again, that the greatest pleasure that this job presents us with is the opportunity to bring you stories of Irish Absolutely. Success on the international stage. And like, it is just, we are going to hit the ground running from Saturday onwards, and there's going to be heartbreak, and there's going to be disappointment, and there's going to be euphoria, and there's going to be people and stories that will surprise us, and there's going to be people who will be household names come the 11th of August that a lot of people may not be familiar with now. And it is the beauty of the Olympics.
Oh, it is so exciting. And when it comes to equality, this statistic is worth noting. Here's former Irish Olympian Hannah Craig, slalom canoeist.
A really important one for me is this is the first ever 50-50 Olympics. So this is the first time we're going to have very close to the same number of female athletes as male athletes. So 49.4%. And that is a historic moment for the Olympic movement and for sport, full stop. And Team Ireland is right up there with 49.6% female athletes. I think that's a really important piece. And the women's marathon as well is going to close these Olympics. There's a lot of symbolic gestures here that are really important. Mm.
And in the 100 years since our first participation in the Olympics, we've won 35 medals. So how are we looking for Paris? Obviously, we're greedy. But in that most HR of terms, should we manage our expectations? Here's Sarah Keane, president of the Olympic Federation of Ireland, on Morning Ireland, because, as it turns out, and she told Gavin, there is a formula.
You have to create the double the amount of opportunities to medal. So if you want to get, let's say, 8 medals, you need about 16 opportunities to medal across those sports to really see if it can happen for you. So we're very confident that we have those opportunities, and we're going to need our team to perform at their best at the time that counts. And obviously we're also going to need a bit of the luck of the Irish as well, because that's sport for you.
Rubbing the shamrock raw as we speak. And extra swig of coffee to you if you can name this gold medal winner. Gold medal.
I was the first ever boxer, win a gold medal, but like, we'd won a lot of medals prior to that as well, back in the day as well. So it was great that we finally got over that hurdle, and now obviously Kelly winning a hurdle Olympic gold medal and Katie winning an Olympic gold medal. So we need another boy this time now to win another Olympic medal.
It is, of course, Michael Carruth, Barcelona, 1992. But it turns out the boxer had to put on his game face in order to even get in the Olympic ring.
I was expected to lose against Juan Hernandez Sierra from Cuba. You know, 6'7", me 5'7" on me tippy toes. You know, both my hands were broken. You know, so it was a lot of things people didn't know about in that fight. We couldn't.
Both your hands were
broken. Yeah, we couldn't divulge it, because I got through the medic. So when you were doing the medics, they were holding your hands and you're trying not to make their face, because you know they see a little clinch or something.
Go
so
away.
So with that, now they weren't bad breaks, but you know, again, the next part was, I was not expected to beat Juan Hernandez. You know what I mean? So, but all the pressure was on him then. You know.
And Oliver also spoke to David Gillick, who was at Beijing in 2008 and had run in the 400 metres.
I remember going down to the warm-up track probably a day or two before my race, and I remember just looking up and seeing the Olympic flame, and it was just so surreal. It was literally, I was just kind of pinch myself moment that I'm actually here at the Olympic Games, and you know, everything that had kind of gone through to get to that moment, and that's what a lot of our athletes kind of, you know, that the things you don't see, the graft, the hustle over the years, the lifetime of work that goes into that moment. And I got to be honest, like, the Olympics for me, it didn't go as planned. And, you know, it's great to hear the success stories, but there'll be a lot of athletes that may come back a little bit disappointed. And I was one of them coming back from Beijing. It just didn't pan out the way I wanted to. But, you know, it's probably in subsequent years you look back and you know, the memories and everything that went into that, like the people around me, my friends, my family, my coach at the time as well. But it's one of those moments that, you know, you cherish, because the Olympics is the pinnacle of my sport, athletics. And it was great to be there and great to be part of a great team.
And later on with Ray, Kenny Egan came into studio.
How are you, Ray?
Michael Carruth on this morning. Now you're on. Yeah, no, not me, because I wasn't here, but they had him on.
Olympic gold medalist, of course. Yeah.
He didn't bring his medal in.
No,
so you did one
better. That's very selfish.
Because Kenny brought his in, the silver in the light heavyweight boxing, Beijing 2008. But their opening ceremony, all that razzmatazz, he'd skipped it.
So when we're at the Beijing, the draw is made the day of the opening ceremony. So everybody weighs in and the draw is made for boxing. And I was up first. So I was boxing the following day. So I couldn't go to the opening ceremony because there was too much involved in getting there and hanging around and the heat and the humidity and all those type of things. I had to stay back in the apartment and make way to weigh in the following morning to fight that day. So I missed the close.
How were you making weight in your hotel room?
In the apartment. We stayed in the Olympic Village.
What were you doing?
A bit of skipping.
Oh, a bit of
skipping. Yeah, just to keep an eye on the weight. And went to bed then and was up nice and fresh the next morning to go and weigh in.
Right.
You have to weigh in every day you fight.
Yeah.
So I had to be 81 kilos or less.
Yes, the 81 is written on the back of the medal.
That was my weight.
Yes,
so went out the next morning to weigh in, all good. And I nearly missed the closing ceremony because I was being drug tested after the final. So I got to the tail end of the closing ceremony.
Right.
So, you know, everyone's Olympics is different.
Kenny Egan, but he's in Paris this time around, so we'll get to see it all. And as for the rest of us, settling into the couch, remote to hand, family bag of Doritos, we are about to become experts in pretty much everything. Oh God, he went with the triple axel.
Do you know what the most beautiful thing about the Olympics is, and particularly with Ireland? And, you know, I think you know where I'm going with this. Whether it's rugby sevens, or remember Annalise Murphy with the sailing?
Yes.
Just those lads that never put their foot on water just became absolute sailing experts overnight. There's nothing as fantastic. I was in a pub, I won't say where it is, it's on Dorset Street in Dublin, and I nipped in for a cheeky pint, and there was a fella telling me about the wind ratio and the tensile strength of sails.
No, but I know you're...
We're just very fast learners, Bernard O'Shea. Don't know what your problem is. And to that, we give you the latest Olympic sport. Think downrocks, power moves, spin.
It feels like the 1980s have called and want their ball back.
That's Barry Kenny. You probably know him as the trains guy, but here he's all about breakdancing. Sorry, we're not total squares here on Playback. We know, kids, it's called breaking. And that's just the start of it.
The athletes don't call themselves athletes. They're B-boys and B-girls, okay?
Mm.
And here's how it works. Is basically, you've got throwdowns, okay, which is effectively dance-offs against each other. So they're all going to be in a pool. They'll go against each other in a group of four. And one against one, the DJ comes along and plays a random beat. And they
and that's the key, is it? It's a random beat. They don't have any idea what's coming.
Exactly. Now, there's obviously different types of beats, different paces or whatever, and they will know DJs and they will know DJ styles because the DJs are every bit as much as part of the breaking event as the B-boys and B-girls are themselves. And in an individual contest, you have three throwdowns. And this kind of reminds you of the rapping scenes in 8 Mile or indeed in kind of Run DMC videos in the past where somebody does their dance.
Explain to me where the skill is in this, though, because let's just say that I'm B-boy, P to the B to the Boucher Hayes. Do I compete with a DJ of my choice or against the DJ?
Oh, no. No, 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 no. We're stopping that right there.
P to the B to the Boucher Hayes.
Not to be encouraged. Back in a bit. Welcome back. All week on Liveline, callers reacted to the RTE and Irish Mail on Sunday documentary Bishop Casey's Buried Secrets. It featured an interview with Eamon Casey's niece, who claimed he had first raped her at the age of 5 and that the sexual abuse had continued for years. The documentary also revealed that the Limerick Diocese paid over €100,000 in settlement to one of Bishop Casey's accusers after Casey's death. At the start of the week, callers talked about their shock and feelings of betrayal, particularly when it came to the funeral and the burying of the bishop in the Galway Cathedral.
How many bishops celebrated the funeral mass for Eamon Casey in Galway Cathedral?
11 bishops and 61 priests. And there's a photograph as well, Joe, of the bishops processing up the centre of the cathedral.
Okay.
Now, tell me all of those bishops were innocent and knew nothing about Eamon Casey. It's unbelievable that he got such a funeral.
Your point, please, Una.
Hi, Joe. Sorry, I'm not coming across as a holy as thou person.
Yeah, okay.
I just feel that I know I have to be sensitive to his family and his son, but I do feel that it'd be a great message to the victims of Bishop Casey in small bishop in inverted commas. that he be reinterred, exhumed from the grave in the cathedral in Galway, and reinterred in the family plot somewhere in Kerry, because I think it'd be a great message.
You're asking people to boycott it for weddings or christenings or even
funerals. I mean, it's gorgeous buildings, beautiful building inside and out. I know it well. It's a lovely place to go inside for a bit of peace and quiet, say a prayer. But I can't see, I would ever see the building in the same light again, and certainly will not darken the doors.
As far as this man being in the cathedral, I think he should be removed from the crypt.
Okay.
And I also think wherever he is buried, they should put a plaque up over him and all the other ones that are dead, with detailing their activities, let's say, with the knowledge of the church, the knowledge of Rome, and so everybody will know who they were and what they were and what they did.
And those calls for Eamon Casey to be removed from the crypt continued all week, particularly as people phoned in to tell Joe about their stillborn babies who had been refused burial in consecrated ground. One such caller was Mary.
Myself and my husband had a stillbirth back in 2003.
Yeah.
So she was full term.
Yeah.
She died in my womb. So my husband went along to our local parish and tried to arrange a priest for the funeral. And the priest asked, well, did your baby die inside or outside the womb? To which he replied, inside. The priest said, we can't bury her. We can't bury her. Yeah, we can't give her a funeral.
Did he say why?
No. My husband was distraught enough.
Yeah,
you know?
Of course. And you, I presume. Yes.
Yeah. So actually, Joe, my husband told me this last Christmas.
Okay, that's what he told you.
Because
okay.
He didn't. He just kept it in and kind of told me that there wasn't a funeral, there wasn't a space for her or whatever.
Okay, he wanted to protect you from the awfulness of what that priest had done and said. Did you have a name? Had you have a name?
Orla. Basically, you know, had she been alive for 2 seconds, sure, there, give her a funeral. She's worthy of it. But she wasn't worthy of it because she died inside my womb full term on her due date.
And when Mary learned of what had happened, she approached the church.
I got very angry last Christmas. So a couple of months ago, we got on to, I don't know whether I can say Archbishop Dermot Farrell.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, he's a Catholic Archbishop of Dublin, yes.
So we had a meeting with himself.
Okay.
He suggested, he asked, would we like a blessing now? And we said, no way, it's too late.
Okay.
Like 20 years after the fact, it's too late.
But he was receptive to meeting you and he did hear you.
He did listen, yeah.
Yeah. And has the position changed? And he's a very compassionate man. Has the position changed?
Well, he kind of said, well, what can we do? And we asked, we suggested that we would like an apology.
Yeah, okay.
So he sent us back to the local priest and we had to chase all that up. We got an apology, but it wasn't from the heart. It was a very, very cold apology.
It was a written apology or...?
Yeah, it was well typed, yeah.
Yeah.
And even got our baby's name wrong and our second name wrong because of what happened to her.
Yeah.
We never really put her name on the gravestone.
Okay.
Now, they were willing to pay for that.
The church were.
Yeah, and we said no thanks.
Mary on Tuesday's Liveline. And as the week progressed, the anger only seemed to deepen.
Joe, my point is that I think Bishop Casey's remains should be torfed out of the cathedral. What he has done is unspeakable.
I was brought up a Catholic, baptised, made my communion, made my confirmation, got married in the Catholic Church. I have children myself and I'm raising them as Catholics. And after watching that documentary the other night, I'm done.
From Liveline. Now to Sunday, because if the Olympics weren't enough for you, we now have Croke Park, Sam Maguire. On the news at 1, former Armagh player from 2002, Oisín McConville, spoke to Rachel.
Somebody actually said to me earlier,
if he's win the All Ireland, he's lose the running ourselves. Well, I'm afraid it's too late. That's already happened. We've completely lost the run of ourselves. I think I've never seen excitement like it. People keep telling me that 2002 was better, if not a match for what's going on. But I don't recall any of the madness that's been going on here. But I have young kids now who obviously have grown up and know nothing but failure as far as Armagh are concerned. So to watch it through the prism of their eyes and realise how much it means to people, I mean, I think this is the culmination of 10 years hard work in order to get here. We feel as if we have a great chance. The buzz and the razzmatazz that's going on around the county is absolutely unbelievable. Everybody's in good form. It's all about football.
Oh, it certainly is in Galway.
It's going to be a really tense match to watch Galway play Armagh and hopefully Galway win.
I think they're going to do very well and win the final.
I think Galway's going to win by a few goals and a few points and do very well.
Who's your favourite player?
Damien Comer or John Maher.
I think we're going to beat them on penalties.
How's Galway going to do in this All-Ireland?
I'd say they'd beat them and they'd beat them 10 times again.
Galway versus Armagh will be very entertaining, but not really, because we all know that Galway's going to win.
Oh, cuteness turned up to 11. Sally Ann Barrett brought us those voices from Morning Ireland. Headcase, the name of a one-man show by Gavitt Keogh. It's subtitled The Love Song of an A&E Patient. And when Ricochet, for it was he, in the arena hot seat on Tuesday, put this to the playwright and actor, well, Keogh brought it.
Garrett, tell us about what happens in Headcase.
Well, a man goes to the A&E, the E&R, the E.D., call it what you will, is where you never want to be. And it's about, he's had a bang in the head, so he has to stay there. He needs to be looked at, looked after. And of course, it becomes a saga, as anyone who's been involved in that, you know, knows it. And it goes on all through the day, it goes on all through the night. But from an artistic point of view, it just shows like what happens to the guy, and some of the people he meets, some are very nice and some are a bit, in need of help. For example, he meets a woman who looks very bad, like she's maybe well out of it. And it's for some reason, having been there most of the day, she gets up to go. And he looks at her and she turns to him and she says, "What are you looking at? You, what are you looking at? You see me? I'm wandering in a haze of blood for all the good it does me. I told the doctors there's a fire, I said, a fire up in my brain. It's causing me such pain. I want to light a match, catch the white, the dragon snatch, step outside, use the loo. My heart, my soul are splitting too. All I know, this is the glue that plasters over, gives me cover, lets me be a better lover of myself and sometimes others. So excuse me, friend, while I explain. And you, what are you looking at too? To you and her and him, I'm wandering, hollow-eyed and hilly-eyed, looking like I'm pilly-eyed, but never, ever, ever judge the book by just its cover, because if you could see the me inside, I'm shimmering and glimmering, I'm a bleeding illuminating here, I'm shooting like a brilliant silver star, see me shining from afar, inside of me I'm golden like the moon, I'll be a fighter very soon. Except, you see, I took the punches early rounds, and parts of me stayed on the ground. But by this hazel wand and cherry stick, this rustling foil, this holy oil, I'll find love lost, I'll kiss his lip. Doctor, doctor, I said, doctor, I light a fire up in my brain, incendiarise the pain. Do you like that word? Even if it is myself, I said, I'm burning with the flame. You see? Do you see? I am not incapable of lucidity. Just that every day it comes a gnats less frequently.
Ooh, from Arena. In America on Sunday, Joe Biden announced he wouldn't be running. Kamala Harris, it is. A great laugh, but will it be enough to upend the Republican apple cart? We'll have to see in November. And in the US, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addressed Congress there for a record fourth time against the backdrop of protests. And when Kamala Harris met Netanyahu, she said that it was time for this war to end. On Morning Ireland, Gavin spoke to Julia Manchester, political correspondent with The Hill.
The protests outside the White House, the low-key nature of the meeting between the two leaders, the comments from Kamala Harris, and yet, Is there any sign of any real change in support from America for Israel's war on Gaza?
You know, at this point, no. I think what we saw in terms of the meetings at the White House, the photo op meeting between Kamala Harris and Benjamin Netanyahu, as well as President Biden's meeting with him, I don't think it signals a major change. There could have been some movement behind closed doors, but we did not hear of any major shift. I think the president's rhetoric on towards Netanyahu represents a bit more pressure against him. But, it still seems that the Biden administration is taking a very pro-Israel stance.
From Morning Ireland yesterday. And on Tuesday's Drive Time, Sarah spoke to Dr. Ahmed Youssef, an American doctor who has returned from working with a medical NGO in Gaza. And as you can appreciate, what he witnessed is deeply distressing.
The carnage and the harm and the human suffering that we saw on this trip, it was surreal. And even speaking about it now, processing it, it's a remarkable experience. I really can't really put completely into words.
You were working in the emergency department in the Al-Aqsa hospital. I know, and I know it's very difficult, as you say, to put into words some of what you saw, but can you tell us some of your, I suppose, strongest memories of what you saw working there day to day?
Yeah, so the entire infrastructure of healthcare in Gaza has been systematically destroyed, and so there's only three public hospitals left, Al-Aqsa being one of them. And it was never meant to be a trauma hospital, but every hospital is a trauma hospital now in Gaza. And what we would have is a combination of medical patients that are overloading the healthcare infrastructure because there's no medications, no refrigerations for insulin and those type of things. And so the ER is full of people just ill from the exacerbations of their chronic medical problems. And then every 6 to 12 hours, we would get a mass casualty event where we would have people, children, women, civilians coming in pieces to the hospital in different stages of death and dying. The experience of really feeling for the first time in my career that no matter how well I was trained and no matter how long I've been doing this, that so many people, we just couldn't help. There was a helplessness and a hopelessness in recognizing that many of the people that were coming to our doors with their family members holding them in their arms were not going to be able to be helped because there were no supplies. We didn't have enough hands and bodies to help, and we didn't have space. And so this was a constant triaging who gets to live and die is a theoretical thing in when we live in the first world that we live in and are quite privileged. And unfortunately, on the ground in Gaza, it's an hour-to-hour reality.
And with almost 40% of the population in Gaza under the age of 14, children are among the many dead.
I can't articulate very well the fact that I saw more kids die in my 3 weeks there than I've seen in my entire career, and I expect to see in the rest of my career, unless I'm back in Gaza. And so it's a travesty, really.
And he talked about the extremely difficult decisions he was forced to make.
In that triaging operation that you were doing hour to hour, were there often patients that you had to choose not to treat who perhaps could have survived if you were in a position to treat them?
Every day. So every day, myself and my Gazan physician peers and nurses had to make decisions in the moment of who gets the machine to breathe for them, who truly has a chance to survive in an environment where we don't have wound care supplies, we don't have appropriate operating theaters to treat, neurosurgical emergencies. It was an everyday decision every time one of these mass casualties happened, who we'd have to physically move to the edges of the trauma bay because we couldn't help them. And often those patients, unfortunately and sadly, died in front of us, and there was nothing to do.
Dr. Ahmed Youssef with Sarah on Drive Time. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Now to Wednesday morning, just after 10 a.m, Sinn Féin leader Mary Lou MacDonald and Philip Boucher-Hayes. The interview lasted 18 minutes and was not short on, well, how shall we put this, moments. Its focus, the party's newly launched policy on immigration.
So our approach, to summarise it, is to say simply this: you do not place these centres for very vulnerable cohorts of people who need support in very, very deprived, struggling, neglected areas, by the way, neglected by successive governments and for generations, and their neglect is the responsibility of government and government alone, not any newcomer to our shores. Let me make that absolutely clear. But they are not appropriate locations for these centres and services. Where and we can objectively verify that it shouldn't be an arbitrary thing. Where centres and where provision is located, equally there still has to be a dialogue, an engagement and a consultation with the wider community. Because as a matter of basic common sense and good order, where change comes to any neighbourhood or community, where new people are introduced for whatever length of time to any neighbourhood or community, the sensible, orderly, friendly, constructive way to go about that is with maximum consultation and conversation, not the approach of the government, which has been to ignore all of that. And at the heart of our approach, therefore, is community. It's about living in the real world and recognising people's lived realities. It's about getting the system right in a way that protects our social cohesion and to have a system that enjoys public confidence.
And while the Suttons and Hokes and Terenures would not have the right of veto, there would be community consultation. Cue more questions. And because there was a lot of over and back, we will play this clip in full.
So you're saying that in order to beef up that audit process, to beef up that consultation process, that you want to throw extra resources at this, a tripling of staff numbers at the International Protection Office, a tripling of resources for the Appeals Tribunal. Has Sinn Féin worked out how much that's going to cost? I mean, you're talking about up to 1,000 civil servants. Are they going to be newly recruited members of the civil service, or are you going to take them from elsewhere? And if you are going to take them from elsewhere, what departments are you going to leave short-staffed?
Well, firstly, I have to refute again any notion that the type of consultation, the type of engagement with communities that we propose, that is our policy, is taking place. It's simply not. And the government...
Okay, we've heard you on that. Let's get to the question there, though.
Yes, and secondly, to say to you, you're misquoting the policy when we were talking about the tripling of capacity. The tripling of capacity is correct.
Tripling staff numbers at the IPO from 400 to 1,200, tripling of resources for the iPad. I'm reading it from the document.
Yes.
So have you costed that, and where are they going to come from?
Excuse me, if you don't mind. That is not for the purpose of community engagement, as you have suggested. That is around the issue of efficient processing of applications. The number of international protection applications is growing very, very substantially. The system is very slow. The average application processing time is now 18 months. That's simply too slow. It leaves the applicant in the invidious position of being in a very long limbo. And it means that there is a very late distinction between those who achieve international protection and who must stay and be cared for.
All of which is agreed. Have you costed this reallocation of human resources?
There is a costing for it. I don't have it to hand. It is not enormous. And let me tell you, whatever it is...
1,000 new civil servants is not an enormous cost?
Are you actually interested in hearing the policy or simply nitpicking with me? Whatever it costs, it needs to be done. By the way, the government, for your information...
Let's pause. Take a swig of coffee. There was more.
So
hang on a second. There is a costing. You don't have it, and you can't tell us at the moment where those civil servants would come from to commit to the IPO and the IPAT. No, I want to move on. I want to move on to the next thing, the next platform plank of this new policy. You want to move away from a reliance on the private market to remove profiteering. So does the government. Are you not again doing exactly as they're doing?
Well, first of all, I have to say that your tone with me in this interview is extremely rude. But be that as it may, the government may claim that this is their approach. It is something that they have failed to do. This was signposted 5 years ago by Catherine Day, and they still haven't done it. I'm less interested, and I would have thought, as a journalist and a broadcaster, you would be far more inquisitive, not simply around what the government is saying, which you're very happy to repeat ad nauseum, but actually what the government is doing, or in this case, has failed to do.
So are you committing then to what was recommended by Catherine Day and the Direct Provision Advisory
Group?
Yes,
it's the correct approach, yeah.
So you will build 6 and maybe up to 15 different asylum centres?
Yes.
And they talked about the designation of safe countries and the enforcement of deportation orders. And that brought us back around again to the issue of resources.
But what sort of resources do you see yourself dedicating to this? I mean, do you envisage dedicating Department of Justice officials, Gardaí?
Philip, can I just say to you, the resources that are required, this is a policy document. I lead the opposition. I'm not the minister. I'm not the responsible party in government at this point. We have set out, I think, very clearly, a very balanced, a very clear methodology and approach and value system for dealing with this issue. Year on year, of course, the resource requirement will vary and it will have to be met. And that will be a matter for successive budgets. Those resources will be made available.
But Mary Lou, what is a policy document without costings, without an idea of what the resources required, other than a wish list?
No. Policy documents set out the policy apparatus, the frameworks and the approach. I will listen with interest, Philip, and to your colleagues, as and when you have others setting out policy proposals and a similar demand for exact costing line by line. That's not what policy documents and position papers do, and you really should know that.
Everybody coming on here will receive exactly the same level of robust interrogation.
I'm delighted to hear it.
Are you making a political...
Sinn Féin's Mary Lou MacDonald and Philip Boucher-Hayes on Wednesday. And there's only one way to follow that.
People ask me, you know, do I get fed up of singing Total Eclipse of the Heart or Hero, you know?
Yeah.
Of course I don't. I love it because everybody, you know, it brings the nostalgia back and everybody has a good time.
Bonnie Tyler. And that hit was written by Jim Steinman.
He finished off writing Total Eclipse of the Heart that he'd started writing many years before. As a vampire a song in there that he was thinking of doing a musical about vampires and things.
Yeah.
But he rewrote the song and he gave it to me.
Wait, look, you know what people are saying? Play the song, play a bit of the song at least. It's a true classic, Bonnie. A true classic.
So yes, so come and hear it live.
Yes. Leopardstown, the 8th of August. It's not true, Bonnie, that song was offered to Meatloaf before you. That's not true.
Well, every time I saw Meatloaf after that, he said, Bonnie, that song was made for me. I said, tough, he gave it to me.
What a woman, the magnificent Bonnie Tyler. And leave it to the Mooney Goes Wild team to take a listener to task for all manner of misdemeanours. Colleen McLaughlin had contacted the programme with a question.
This flower, it's in the mustard family. This one, it's called hedge mustard. Again, it's not a flower that you would regard as a beautiful flower. It's quite ordinary, but it has a distinctive shape. So I can recognise it immediately when I see it. And that's when it occurred to me to ask the question, why do wildflowers have such a distinctive look that we humans, you know, can instantly recognise them, and yet the flowers themselves, because they have no eyes, they can't recognise each other.
Here she comes.
Colleen, what do you mean calling flowers beautiful and not beautiful? I mean, you said the poor old mustard wasn't much good and you didn't even say what colour the vervain was. That's not fair to be saying they're beautiful. Do flowers have to be beautiful? I mean, is that what their job in life is? I mean, the reason why they have flowers is their reproductive part, and that's where your pollen and the pollen in the flowers is brought by insects from one to another. So the insects have to know where they're going. There's no point in going from a daisy to hedge mustard, the pollen won't be any good. So they look the same so that they can be pollinated and they come out at the same time. And in fact, there's been work been done on how an insect knows whether or not the nectar has been taken from the flower. There's different charges in that, so a bee isn't wasting its time going into a flower for nectar or for pollen when it's already been taken away. So there's a huge sophistication in the flowers, whether they look nice or not.
Out of the traps, flowers don't owe you, pretty man. But Colleen stood his ground.
I think that most wildflowers are beautiful. Do you remember I was saying that, you know, you can tell flowers instantly by their shape or their structure and features like that. But I was wondering, so why are they beautiful? And I thought, what possible reason could there be for that? And I was thinking, maybe it's not that the flowers are beautiful. Maybe they have ended up looking beautiful, but that it's only us humans who see them as beautiful because we are programmed to identify them, you know, for our own benefit, you know, so that we recognise them and take an interest in them. Because when we were hunter-gatherers, we would go out looking for specific plants to gather. So maybe over the years that we started to see that plants were beautiful, you know, because that's just our perception of what beauty is.
So there. But for Richard Collins, pretty matters, as us uglies know all too well.
Well, gather ye rosebuds while ye may. Old time he is a-flying. Now, what is a display all about? It's usually about getting a suitable sexual partner in order to transfer your genes onto the next upper in the next generation. Now, it seems to me, I'm trying to put myself in the place of a plant. Suppose I'm a foxglove. Well, I want to attract pollinators in so that they will take my pollen to the next flower. But there's a higher order here. How do I ensure that the bumblebee goes to a well-endowed other plant?
How indeed we want a flower that's fit, healthy, with a certain je ne sais quoi. Matthew Jebb of the National Botanic Gardens stepped in.
What Charles Darwin spotted was that different flowers attract different pollinators. So he saw, for example, that a honeysuckle smells beautifully fragrant at night, and it's got a star-shaped white flower that moths visited. So it was, in fact, moth pollination has this syndrome of all sorts of characteristics. And likewise, he realised he could predict, when you looked at a flower, he could say that flower is pollinated by butterflies or by birds or by bees or by flies. And it was an incredible step forwards. So what Colleen is saying there in looking at a vervain and hedge mustard, he has seen the same thing that might attract a pollinator. So I think that's a very good observation, that it might not just be the flower, it's the whole sort of gestalt, the whole sort of look of the plant that brings the bee in. And we know.
Oh, that is interesting. From Mooney Goes Wild. Now, this next clip, don't know what to make of it. From the archives. Thanks, I think, to Sure 'Twas Better.
Once again, it's the Bronco Show. Hello again, and welcome to the Bronco Extravaganza, sponsored by the people who make toilet tissues better every day and used by all leading cowboys. We start today's programme with a nice gentle number written by Frank Zappa,
called The Torture Never Stops. Does that music conjure up visions of pale green bathrooms and fur-lined toilet seats? And you happen to be in a loo, aren't you the lucky one? Yes, folks, only our Polo range of toilet tissues can give you that coconut glow all over.
Is that a kind of a tape someone sent in that found its way into the archives by mistake?
Oh my word, there's I'm so inconsolable after it. Yeah. Well, I mean, I hope it was real. I'm going to have to go and have a look now and see. But and if all leading cowboys are using it to salve their, quite frankly, sore arses. Oh my word.
The torture never stops. There was so much in it.
If you found yourself in a bathroom and you get to use Bronco, you're going to have a coconut glow all over. It sounds like a fever dream. Like, what's happening?
Oh, that is maybe the best thing. I really hope that's real.
Sweet mother of avocado bathrooms. And by the way, we had to edit out quite a bit of that, it being a Saturday morning. And that is it from this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.
Ford Mustang. Bang.